My Chops TV.
You will be chopped.
Know what that means? Licking my chops.
Today I will show you how to do a karate chop.
Simply saying, no, he doesn't have the chops to do what it takes.
New thing. I'm busting chops.
Welcome to Chops TV, featuring Jennifer Lopez. Now here's Chops.
Chops TV, Chops and J-Lo with you again. We want to remind you here at the beginning of the episode that we have a live version of our podcast coming up next Saturday. Well, if you're listening to this in real time, that would be May 11th, 2024, for those of you that are outside the year even. But at Grandview Theater and Draft House, we're watching The Fall Guy, and then after, we're going to record a live podcast. So that is the 1:30 p.m. showing just right there on Grandview Avenue in Grandview. But we still have a pair of tickets that we might be able to get you because nobody has correctly guessed the best performance, in my opinion, that Emily Blunt has given in a movie. So get on that, people.
Yeah, do that. What are you waiting for?
Just submit it to @_ChopsTV on Twitter, and you could be the winner. Again, it is still up for grabs, and you would have a chance to get those two tickets, come see a good movie. Well, hopefully a good movie. I haven't seen it yet. I will see it for the first time on that Saturday.
It'll be my birthday, too. Worst comes to worst, you could win tickets to the movie, show up late if you don't care about Emily Blunt or Ryan Gosling, and then just have a beer with me at the Grandview Theater Bar.
Yeah. Grandview Theater and Draft House, Saturday, May 11th, 1:30 p.m., Fall Guy, Chops TV, right after it. This week, we watched two movies that I think you could say are kind of from the same cloth, but they go very different tones. And we'll start with the one we watched on streaming. On Prime, there is an Anne Hathaway starring vehicle called The Idea of You, and it's very much a romantic movie, but it definitely has some comedic aspects to it, so while it was, I thought it was good, I don't know how to rank it into our search for the next great rom-com mission that we're on.
Let me start by saying that I sound like this because on Friday morning and afternoon, I was the CEO of puking into a toilet. So that's why I sound like this.
She had a great quarter, by the way, for that business.
Yeah. Really cornered the market on puking into a toilet specifically, followed shortly by spitting into trash can next to my bed. Anyway, so I think that we should consider it in the running for the best rom-com this year. However, as far as rankings go, even though it should be realistically at the top of the list, I don't think it can be because Anyone But You is, in the most genuine sense, a romantic comedy, whereas this one feels a little bit more like a romantic dramedy.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, because it didn't even have really comedic set pieces, or it didn't even really have like a comic relief character, like a best friend or something. I mean, there was a few other characters, but not quite the same as what you normally get from it. But I still really enjoyed it, and there were a few times where I legitimately laughed out loud, which is something, have you ever noticed that, especially at home when watching a movie, you might be entertained by the thing that's funny, a movie or a TV show, but you don't actually laugh like physically all that much. You just kind of take it in and be like, I was entertained by that.
No. I notice actually a lot, especially recently, how much I like laugh. I like do a ha ha, like a deep, hearty chuckle at things that I find genuinely funny.
Yeah, but do you ever watch something and just realize that you were entertained but didn't actually laugh?
Yes, but
that's what I'm saying.
Oh, I see. If I find something funny, I'm busting out laughing, though.
Except for those times that I say something funny, and you just look at me and go, that's so funny.
But those are the funniest things that you say.
And you're not going to say that to a movie. That would be foolish.
Yeah.
Yeah. You stick with that's so funny for me. Okay. I'll take it. Idea of You, though, you were spot on with this, but it looks like it from the beginning, that it looks to be a fan fiction or at least like a Wattpad adaptation, but it was a little perplexing to us because we're like, well, Anne Hathaway's in it. And even the guy, even though he's a younger actor, what's his name? Nicholas Galitzine?
I don't know how to say his last name.
Something like that. But he's around right now. He's actually, he's like right on the cusp of like becoming somebody.
Oh, yeah. He's like It Boy sure 2024.
So that's two people that, no, this is not like a even like Cole Sprouse level like adaptation, which he's been in a few of those. This had a higher production value, better actors, better directing. It just looked, it didn't look cheap to me. So that was refreshing at first, but you can tell by the story that it is definitely based in that fan fiction world.
Yeah, it's, the premise is 40-year-old divorcee with a heart of gold falls in love with the it boy from the aging boy band group.
Yes.
Right. And so like that celebrity meets art gallery owner and like loves her for her, you know, that is ripped right out of fan fiction storylines.
And then entering spoiler territory, but because her daughter is not only still a teenager and in high school, but also a fan of this boy band, that creates some issues with her as the relationship goes on and whether or not she can do this, or was this just a fun summer fling? Is it just that they are in love with the idea of you, but not actually in love with each other? Oh, wow. That's where the title comes from.
The author, back to being more fan fiction, the movie definitely plays on us being able to recognize those fan fiction sensibilities. So like for the real tried and true fanfiction.net, you know, the OGs will recognize that the movie is at least trying to play it off as this is inspired by One Direction. And the main dude is supposed to be Harry Styles. Like he has all his like wacky, like weird misplaced tattoos and, you know, singer, songwriter, you know, British guy.
Yeah.
So he's got all the ingredients are there. But the author just a couple of days ago or before the release of the movie released an article that she wrote for Time Magazine.
What's her name? Robin Lee, who she was actually a character in the second and third 50 Shades movies.
Really?
Which I just think is a funny, like, full circle.
She's
not a very famous actress, but she has had some roles along there. And then this was just a book she wrote. So I guess she got the fan fiction bug, kind of.
Well,
just wrote her out.
I guess, twist my arm, I have to rewatch 50 Shades of Grey. But
well, she's not in the first one. So you got to watch 50 Shades Darker and 50 Shades Freed.
50 Shades.
Here, you read the quote. I'll figure out who she played in the 50 Shades movies.
So I don't have a quote, but the article is titled "Reducing the Idea of You to a Fan Fiction is Another Example of Dismissing Women's Art." So in this article, she goes on to say that, no, it is not inspired by Harry Styles. Like, the internet made that up and it was a reach. This isn't a One Direction fanfic. This is about, really about like X, Y, and Z, about like, you know, women aging in Hollywood and a commentary on like what spaces like we are forced to navigate after we've reached a certain age and like our value.
Sure, that's the fiction part. And,
sure, yeah.
I don't buy that for an instant. Like it's definitely about One Direction. Like that's clearly the inspiration for it.
So for the book, I don't think so, because that's not what she's saying. She said that it was taken from an amalgamation of like her personal experience is like other things that have inspired her, but it's not specifically. I think she's saying that
this isn't
that
just her thirsting
idea,
over One Direction.
Correct. Like we're superimposing this juvenile, you know.
That almost feels like though she is more embarrassed to be a fanfic adjacent actually like defending her work there. Like it. Tell it for what it is. Like, I mean, that's what fan fiction is. Some people, she was in some of the 50 Shades movies, which is literally fan fiction that they changed around enough to not be in the Bella Edward world and instead was in the 50 Shades world. But that's what it is. It's a Bella Edward fan fiction. And I'm sorry. Authorial intent is important, but like, that's not what you did here. You did not make something wholly original. This is so clearly based off of things that exist in the real world.
Yeah. I'll have to reread the article again, because in one vein, I do agree with you. The author's intent matters, but it's now spun into this whole different thing. But I think like the most interesting part about that article was her making commentary on like women's media and like women's art. about how it's often like infantilized and made as like juvenile and like it's a joke, when it can still say really like deep, meaningful things about like women and like our place in society and like our inner turmoils and feelings about aging and stuff and like the shit that we have to go through, while also being like a fun little story about, you know, a cougar.
Yeah. I agree with that part. I think that there's a lot of, especially like, think of how many women will watch movies that are quote unquote like guy movies, but how many guys go around and turn back and do the same thing for all the quote unquote girl movies. Or there's always such a big deal made about it. Like, oh, I watched The Notebook. Oh, I think that there's definitely something to that. And I think that there's plenty of thought provoking things within this movie, that it is not just a frivolous romance plot with a young man and this older woman and everything. Yeah. No, there's a lot more to it. And we were even talking throughout it, because there was like questions of like, can she do this? Like with everything going on with her daughter, and just the idea of hooking up with a famous person like that and being thrown into that world. Yeah. I think there's a lot to this movie.
The hypocrisy of her being older than him. Henry Campbell is the famous kid's name in this movie, or this famous very much so above the age of 18 year old's name, versus her husband, who went after the younger colleague, and they have a 20 year age gap, and that doesn't seem to be a problem.
No, it doesn't. The husband's the worst character. Not like he was written poorly, but like he's just a bad person.
Yeah, I will say like he, like unmitigatingly, like sucks. Like he sucks hard. Did have some points though. There were valid points being thrown out towards the end of the movie about how chaotic an environment she's creating for her daughter.
Did he actually care about the daughter?
No.
Or was he just jealous that now she was the one who had a successful, hot, younger partner?
Yeah, that's why he sucks. Because he like didn't mean it with the best intention, but clearly, as like some of the viewers have, and like she discerned from that, it's like, oh, he's coming from a bad place, but he's still making valid points.
And to her credit, she actually takes it in and learns the correct lesson from it. I don't think she was in the wrong to suggest the breakup. And then even like they threw out the 5-year thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's, do you really do that with that much hope, or do you just throw it to kind of make the moment easier? But then they both wait the 5 years and presumably get back together. I don't know. He showed up in her shop and they embraced. We don't know what happened after.
They don't embrace. It ends with her.
Just her crying. Did they not fully embrace?
She gives that happy Anne Hathaway smile, cry, single tear. But I loved that part because it felt earned, right? Like the actual end of the movie, it's sort of why it transcends that romantic comedy genre and enters like romantic dramedy. Because there was like a lot of heart at the end of it. And you do feel bad for her because she's a seemingly a good person, you know, just like trying to find happiness post this like pretty traumatic event in her life.
Yeah. And now
so you just want her to be happy
with her, you know, her marriage doesn't work out. And then she's had to sacrifice as a single mom. She's not as successful clearly as the dad. So he comes out on the winning end of that. And I think, yeah, there's just a little bit, because she mentions at one point, like she doesn't even feel her age. She's turning 40 in this. And then she's talking about how, you know, she had her daughter so young that she never really like went through those things, and like almost like in reverse, now she is sort of in her wilder, I'll say freer adult years. So like after like college and high school, when you're like a partier, if that's what you're into, but you know, when you're before you really settle down and get married and have a family, there's some years there. We're kind of at the tail end of ours at this point, but she didn't really get that. So I think that's why it was kind of not easy for her, but accessible for her to step out into living her life this way. Mm-hmm. And just, hey, daughter is away at summer camp. I can go on this trip. But she kind of realizes that she can only vacation in that world while she still is a mother of an at-home daughter. And that's why they kind of put that year idea on it, so that, hey, her daughter will be fully situated into college, maybe even out of college. And then I will essentially be an empty nester. But she still had to kind of put her life on hold for that.
Yeah.
And she wants to. She does this for her daughter and to make things easier in that sense. But you still, you feel for the motivation, I guess, of how she got past the mental block of, am I really a 40-year-old dating a 24-year-old, however old he's supposed to be, mid to early 20s?
Yeah, which I think for some Americans, the idea of like getting rip-roaring drunk at 21 is like really fun. And then you kind of burn out fast. Mm-hmm. Whereas by the time British kids are 18, 19 years old, they've already been drinking for a few years. And, you know, they'll look at us like going into pubs in England like, who the hell are these jackals and why are they acting a damn fool? Well, it's because like they've already had those experiences and now look back and say, well, you don't know how to handle your liquor. Well, we weren't allowed to handle our liquor earlier. So for her, it's like she had to grow up really quickly and missed out on those experiences. So now that she's finally getting, you know, to live that kind of like have that personal freedom to like make her own choices and do something that is selfishly just for her, the feedback from, you know, the internet in the movie is like, who does she think she is? Who does she think she is? Almost like a jealousy and an envy in that sense. Like, who she can't be with this guy. Like, one woman's like, oh, my daughter loves August Moon and Henry Campbell. Like, you broke her heart, or like her heart, she's heartbroken now.
Hayes Campbell,
yeah. And it just seems like people aren't really allowing this woman to like just let her freak flag fly. And like, why do you even care? This sucks.
If she wants to date the 20-year-old, then let her. The 20-year-old wants to date her. Also has a similar thing where it's like whatever the opposite of arrested development, like expedited development or something.
Yeah.
He has a similar thing because he talks about trying out for this boy band when he was 14. And had he gotten the part on the Oliver Twist stage play, he would have just taken that. But that obviously would have led him down a really different career and life path. But then then for 10 years or so, he's wrapped up in all this August Moon stuff, which he's not really in control of. It's always the record label, really, that's in control of all of these boy bands. So he is somebody also who wants to step out and kind of live his own life as well. And, mm-hmm. and it's not exactly his motivation. He's not trying to do this, but he just meets... We can't talk about their meet cute and how ridiculous it was, but he just meets this older woman and falls in love because she wandered into his trailer at Coachella that she thought was a bathroom, uses the bathroom and comes out and realizes it's his trailer. The one thing I thought that was really funny about that was when his team comes to get him, it's like his publicist or stylist or whatever, and then a security guard. And the security guard like looks at Anne Hathaway like, who is this? And it's like, I don't know, man. She's just a woman who wandered into to his trailer. It seems like you're a little late to doing your security job here.
Yeah, for sure. And it's also funny how like sort of introspective and deep like the first half of this conversation was, and now we're just going to get into, oh, she walked into his trailer at Coachella because she was in the VIP with her daughter and her little friends. Like,
yeah, and it's all
stupid.
It's all serendipitous because she wasn't supposed to go to Coachella. The husband was, or the ex-husband, but he had work stuff that came up, so then she had to take the daughter and her friends to Coachella. The daughter doesn't even want to go to the August Moon thing because she's just kind of grown up past being, you know, a stan of boy bands. But the dad bought the tickets, so she ends up with tickets that she didn't buy for someone who doesn't want them, and then meets this guy in his trailer. But yeah, that it's there's definitely like fantasy fulfillment in it, jet setting on private jets and going across on his European tour. But once you're in the realm of like, well, he's in a boy band, like he could say, hey, this lady's coming along with us. And like rock stars have been known to bring women around with flimsier excuses before. So it feels a little bit more believable, but it's just kind of silly at the beginning. But that's what you get in the rom-com meet-cute world.
Fucking fun. We can have good entertaining movies about nothing, or we could have good entertaining movies with some commentary about the hypocrisy of men and women dating younger people, and then we can have like garbage like the other items on this list. So like, you know, if I recommend this movie and I think that this movie is great, one, it probably is because it is. And then two, it doesn't mean you have to agree.
No, but
also in the sense of like, I think some people are having like cognitive dissonance with like, because Anne Hathaway is like hot and 40. It like makes sense for her to get with this like guy who's young, like way younger than her.
Right.
For real world situations like that. And I've seen some of this like commentary on Twitter. It's like grooming, where in this specific sense, it is absolutely not the case. Like he's already a very like fully like developed
man. Yes, like, that's a smart. In the book, he is a little bit younger.
He is a little younger.
And the daughter is younger too. She's only 12, so she is still into August Moon.
Yeah, so by aging everyone up, I think like we get away from like grooming accusations and more just like, is it appropriate to date someone half your age? But
and if anything, he's going after her and like constantly pursuing her.
Absolutely.
She turns him down at least 3 or 4 times before she finally decides to go, okay, let's do this.
And she's the one who's mature enough to realize that the relationship at that point is like detrimental to her home life.
Mm-hmm.
And then pulls it. But sidebar, August Moon, not a bad concert. Like it seemed like, you know, at first you were like, well, they're not really doing like the boy band thing. It's probably because, you know, it's like this manufactured thing for the movie for Coachella, but it's not really giving boy band. It's giving like guys on a stage.
The choreography looked very phoned in at first.
But then they really started pulling out the stops. They were doing the in-sync choreography, like basically remaking the One Direction like music videos from their earlier years. It was chef's kiss, really giving. The only other boy band, fake boy band in modern memory that I can say is like as good or like I might have been a fan of had they been in the real world is the boy band from Turning Red.
Four Town
with
isn't
five
the mom confused
members.
Because there's five of them.
Yes.
Right.
It's so good. That song is like legit a banger. It was on like my Spotify, like most played for that year. This one is pretty good. So like the conceit of them being a boy band that's like actually talented is fun. And I believe it. So that's realistic enough, I guess.
Well,
for
you
the
like
story.
Boy bands too, so that
for
helps.
Like, yes, but like a fantasy fulfillment movie, like that's actually seemed pretty realistic. That like this boy band who's like pretty successful and is like aging up still has really avid followers, and it's not going for this, but it definitely could be a commentary on like fandom culture and like the toxicity of when
it could have had a subplot with that kind
of
stuff, but it doesn't really get into it very much. Yeah.
Yeah. But there is definitely like, there's something there that is not for this because they're too hot and too horny.
So yes, I would recommend it. It is currently on Amazon Prime. If for the ladies out there, encourage your husband, boyfriend, significant other, friend, whatever, to watch it, because I think they probably will enjoy it. I guess maybe know your audience to a certain degree, but it is not, it's also not as like kind of slow and dour in some ways as like something like The Notebook. It's a little more fun.
It's so fun. It's so much fun. It's really hot.
That's another thing. Also, don't watch it with children. It is rated R for its depictions of intimacy.
And it's not even like that crazy. Like
it's not graphic.
No, it's definitely not graphic, but it's hot. So like good, get it, girl, you know.
I think like, I said to you at one point, I was like, wait, is fanfic just written porn?
And I said, no, you said it's something like fake porn or like porn adjacent, or yeah, like, or sometimes just porn too. Like but it's so fun and hot and great. It really does remind me of like the height of the rom-com genre, where like you had the hottest people on earth getting together and making a movie, like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, that scene in the bathroom, that's probably the hottest scene, and they don't even really do anything. She like just takes off her wife beater, but meanwhile, we're all just like sweating and salivating. Like that's exactly what a rom-com needs to give.
Mm-hmm.
And we are so close. We're so close. I see it on the horizon, the next great romantic comedy, because now these big actors are signing on board again.
Two more things.
It's so promising.
Real quick, Michael Showalter was the director. Yes, that Michael Showalter from Wet Hot American Summer. He's the main guy who's trying to get the girl in that whole movie. He's been mostly behind the camera in the decades since, but I still thought this was a weird one for him to do, but he did The Big Sick. Remember The Lovebirds on Netflix? That was another rom-com. He did The Eyes of Tammy Faye. He did
I love that. Eyes of Tammy
alert,
Faye movie.
That one that came out with Sheldon earlier this year. He did that. Or I guess it would have been last year at this point in 2023, I believe. But yeah, so behind the camera, this is actually kind of the movie he's been doing, but it surprised me at first when I saw that name. Also, Robin Lee played Ross Bailey in the 50 Shades movies.
Ross Bailey? No, who is that?
I don't know.
Does it give a descriptor?
You'll have to look up Ross.
No, just Google it right now because this is going to drive me crazy.
Okay.
Ross Bailey.
Well, why don't
it must have been like her friend's sidekick or something at the publishing house or someone that he knew. Maybe like someone on Christian's team. I don't really know. But there was maybe it was the helicopter pilot who crashed the helicopter. But
Ross Bailey is VP of Gray Enterprises Holdings Incorporated and Christian Gray's second in command. She has red hair. She is intelligent. She can keep up with Christian in conversations. And he is at ease around her and Gwen. Now, this could be coming from the books rather than the movies, but that's what the 50 Shades of Grey wiki says.
Jesus Christ. It's been a while. Clearly, I need to rewatch this movie. So,
all right. I guess we'll watch that'll be our summer project. We'll watch the 50 Shades movies and we'll let everybody know about it. Are they better than the movie we're about to talk about next? No, but they don't have to be. And this movie should have been better than what it was.
You speak for yourself, but yeah, I agree.
We saw the new Zendaya movie, Challengers, the tennis love triangle, essentially. That's the way to do it. And now we have to enter into spoilers because there's no real way to talk about it because can't even really go like a little in chronologically because the movie isn't exactly set up chronologically. And that's one of my first things that I didn't think it quite needed. They kept going back and forth to the times. It was 2019 and then it was 2009. Mm-hmm. And then apparently there's a 2011 in the middle of there. And they're like, it's just the years just kind of blended together. And I found it was harder to keep track of the story by them going back and forth rather than they could have definitely done the record scratch. Like, how did we get here? And then they go back and go through it. I think that could have worked. But I do think it was too much jumping around in the movie. Choice number one that I did not like.
Yeah. I'm trying to come up with a synopsis for this movie. The closest I've gotten to is like tennis ingenue finds emotional white boys and manipulates them into ruining all of their lives respectively after her career ends early after an injury.
Yeah, I suppose that would be a good one. And yes, yeah, so they're all three very good tennis players, but it appears she is the best when they are younger. And they all meet at the U.S. Open when they are amateurs, and they win the doubles together, and one of them beats the other one for the singles. She wins the singles.
So there's Patrick, Art, and Tashi.
Yes.
Art is...
the blonde one.
The blonde one who is, in present time, Tashi's husband. Art is the washed up pro tennis player
who decided not to go to college, even though they say, oh, you should maybe think about getting an education, too.
He said, I didn't come to play school. I came to play tennis.
And the tennis stuff is another issue with it because I don't know if there was enough to it's 130 minutes long. For this love triangle, there are essentially no other characters of import in the entire movie. It's those three characters. They're around a lot of other people the whole time, but there's nothing else carrying along the story. And so then if you were hoping of getting a tennis, there is some good tennis action. I think they actually did a pretty good job of depicting the tennis to look realistic. I don't watch a ton of tennis, so I don't know for sure. I'm sure there's people who are really into it that would see it as like, yeah, that doesn't look quite right, or that wouldn't happen this way. But except for their final match, there's barely even scores mentioned most of the time they're showing tennis action. So from just a traditional sports movie, two people on either side of the bracket, one's an underdog or something, and they're headed towards each other. They don't really go through that as much. They don't show up a title card. There's not the one where, Art is actually struggling against this lower level opponent and he's going to have to pull out all the stops for a comeback. So they don't hit any of that. And really, honestly, the best part of the movie and the things that saved the tennis scenes are the score. And I didn't want to be that guy to be like, I think this sounds like the score from my favorite movie of all time, The Social Network, but I thought it did. lo and behold, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross did the score. So, yeah, it did actually sound a lot like that. And they just have that, like, methodical, pulsing electronic sound to it. And it fits really well with the tennis scenes.
I will say, I think there were stakes in the movie. It was just personal stakes.
Yes.
It wasn't tennis stakes. And for tennis,
a good sports movie,
fans, not, that was their biggest critique.
Right. And it's
movie.
Not what they were going for. So it's not, it's only like a minus half point in a way. But in a sports movie, you combine both. In a real sports movie, there are some personal stakes and there are competitive sport stakes. And they just didn't have quite enough of those for it to fulfill on the sports side. And the love triangle was fine. Are we sure we want any of them together? Like, that's the other thing, is it was a negative love triangle, which you don't always see. Like, it almost borders on, like, psychological thriller.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The movie felt less of like a... It just felt like a romantic thriller, almost like a indecent proposal or something like that, where, like, this situation that these people are thrown into, it's, like, detrimental to everyone involved in that sense. I will say the music was overpowering at some times. I really liked it in the sense that it served as a metaphor, like, almost like a trigger for the audience to know, like, oh, they're about to go head to head. Conversationally, this is a match, right? They're what's it called? A volley or a rally?
Yeah.
A rally. They're rallying right now in conversation, right? And someone's going to come out on top, but who's it going to be? And when that sound check comes in, and but sometimes it's just too loud. It is just too loud sometimes. It could be thudding in the background, almost like a sense of foreboding, but it just shoves it right in your face and down your throat. And it's a little bit too much.
Yeah.
All that is to say, I did not dislike it. I thought it fit. I thought it fit the environment of the movie very well, with, like, the beat of it hitting the racket and,
So I think I've made it clear that I was at best lukewarm on it. I would not recommend it personally to our listeners here, but it is not like an F type grade for me. Where did you fall on it? Because I know you liked it a little bit more, but is that Zendaya fandom leaking through?
I don't know if it is, because I generally, like, I love Zendaya as, like, a fashion icon, but I'm not super tapped into, like, her roles, right? I think she's great in Dune, but I'm not, like, someone else could have been Chani. I think I like the character of Chani, the way that she plays that character. In Spider-Man, she's just, like, a girl.
She's really good in Euphoria. And then
she's very good in Euphoria.
What was the one with Denzel Washington's kid? The black and white
Malcolm
one.
Oh, Malcolm and Marie.
Yeah.
So I think that's fine. I'll say this. I don't think she's, like, the most talented actress of her generation, but she definitely has that star quality that, like, brings you in and, like, brings you deeper into a story, which is...
And she's really good for a role like this, kind of that dastard, like, plotting behind the scenes, pulling strings, being the puppet master of everything.
Yeah, she serves that role.
And it's
really
funny
well.
Because she then latches, after her injury and her falling out with the other guy, she latches onto Art. And through her coaching and stuff, makes him, like, a real champion. Like, the whole thing is he's trying to come back from an injury and get back up to speed so he can win the U.S. Open, which is the only one remaining in his career Grand Slam. So that would be, what, it's the French Open, the Australian Open, Wimbledon, and the U.S. Open. So he's waiting to go get that, and that's why he goes to this lower-level tournament. It's kind of a tune-up for him, but it just so happens his old best friend and... rival is almost like
rival, yeah,
romantic rival. they're never quite competitive rivals. Like, there's a rivalry aspect to it, but they're also teammates on the doubles when they're
younger.
Well,
they are. That's the problem, is they are competitive rivals.
They're always competing
for the attention of Tashi. They are always competing in a sense, even when they're not competing. That's why them, like, living together for a really long time, growing up together, playing together, they play the doubles one day, and then the next day it's the junior men's finals, and they're playing each other. So they're always competitors in some sense. But with Tashi and Patrick, they're breeding... No, Tashi and Art.
Tashi and Art.
Yeah, Tashi and Art, because she is playing tennis, like having her career vicariously through him, and he sort of like hits a mental block where he's tired. He doesn't want to go after the Grand Slam. This is going to be his last year. That relationship of coach and mentor tied in romantically with husband and wife is also breeding resentment. Not like a normal resentment that you might find from a more traditional marriage of like, I lost the best years of my life and I could have been out on the town hooking up with girls. It's not that. It's breeding resentment that you have this chance to do something truly great and you're just going to squander it.
Yeah, and she's sitting there like, if my knees fucking worked, I wouldn't be retiring this year.
She said, I would literally stab someone to have the comeback, to make the comeback that you could make, except you're scared. And that she finds repulsive.
What did you think of the decision to kind of connect the triangles on the other end, too? Because there's definitely some, like, homoerotic kind of tension between the two guys throughout the movie. And you and I, like, I mean, they are, it's like apparent when they're trying to do it. There's the one where he comes and visit him at college and he slides the way he slides the chair over.
Closer
and the way they,
to him. Oh, yeah.
That one. And then obviously she gets him to kiss there. And then at the very end, spoiler alert for Challengers, he like catches him when one of them, is it Patrick catches Art,
yeah,
right?
Let's talk about this later because that's a big part of the movie for me. But I will say the elevating the homoeroticism of the movie, I think it works. I think it works really well. I'm not trying to yum anyone's yuck, but like I would definitely I would like to be that churro in that scene when they're aggressively eating the churros and passing it in between their mouths, basically. Like, that is hot. And it adds another layer of it just adds another layer to this romantic love triangle. Usually when it's traditionally in movies, it's two girls going after the same guy. One guy gets the girl and ultimately the other guy finds a different girl or, they reach some sort of consensus, whereas one was better for her all along and the other concedes. This is not like that. They all need each other equally.
But they're
awful
all also
ways.
Kind of bad for each other.
Yes, but they all have like a reliance on each other. So bringing that romantic element into it heightens those personal stakes even more because it's not just like a layer of, oh, this is a friend betrayal. This is a different level of betrayal because of how physically and emotionally close both of these men are. So,
and if you are the one who doesn't end up in the heterosexual relationship, yes. You're kind of left out from both and lose twice.
Yeah. And even professionally though, too, once Patrick is out of the picture, both of them lose a little bit of that drive, right? She still has that drive because she's pushing him, but really competing against Patrick was really like, I want to beat him so I can get her phone number. I want to beat him. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Patrick has a lot more spark to life at this
point,
too.
Yes, yes. Each of them is a very crucial member of that triangle to provide spark and passion in that. But again, it doesn't serve any of them very well from like an emotional well-being standpoint. The gay stuff, too. It seems like... like the idea of like Marilyn Monroe, right back in her heyday, everyone, there's some idiom like men wanted her and women wanted to be her, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's some sense of like envy and attraction. And I think this movie plays with those ideas both very well.
Yeah.
Like both of them want to be Tashi and both of them want to fuck her, right? You know, like... Tashi wants to be Art, you know, in the sense that she wants that career and wants to, you know, this like the really toxic sexual chemistry that her and Patrick have too. You know, it all serves a purpose in the film. That's why I like it. And I don't think it's too much.
So you said you wanted to get to it. We basically get like, is that Rocky 2 where they freeze frame on the ending of him and Apollo Creed fighting?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So I wrote this.
So that's kind of what you get at the end of this one.
So I wrote this down because I'm really bad at metaphors and I wanted to make it a little more clear when I try to say this, how I felt about the ending of the movie. I'm still bad at metaphors, so this might sound stupid, so bear with me. Okay. So I think it's timely to relate it to the Kentucky Derby, what just happened this last weekend. Mm-hmm. So you're watching the Kentucky Derby. Three horses are neck and neck racing, right? When mm-hmm. suddenly the race is over and the camera only caught footage of one horse jumping on top of his horse friend for a hug at the finish line. It's like the tension is building and building, and I'm on board with you, right? The time jumps were a little iffy sometimes. It did get a little bit confusing. Granted, they could have, you know, they could have focused that a little bit more and, you know, condensed the times.
Done some visual evenly. Markers on the characters a little bit better to know like what age they are. Like,
yeah,
you
I don't
do
have
with
a,
hair and stuff.
I don't have a problem with that. You have more of a problem with that. I was able to keep pace with it, but there were a couple parts where I was like, this time jump doesn't really belong here. It should be condensed more into like parts of the film, like larger chunks in the past versus the present. But anyway, all that is to say, throughout the film, every time we revisit that final match, the tension is growing, right? We're learning more about the characters. We're reaching this apex. We're there. It's super fucking intense. Tennis is a really intense sport. She's into it. The crowd's into it. They're into it. They're getting closer to the net. They're rallying. They're going for it. And then we never find out who wins. So when you're talking about stakes, there are a ton of personal stakes. And I don't think people might not agree with this take of mine. But the fact that we don't know who wins sort of negates all that tension that we build up.
We don't know who wins romantically or competitively.
Right. All the stakes are thrown out the window. None of it matters. Whose line is it anyway? Because we don't know. And I think the movie is trying to say, well, it doesn't matter who wins because that's not what the movie is about. It's not about the tennis. But the tennis is the vehicle for that tension to escalate.
Something has to happen at the end of your movie.
There is, to me, it just felt like, not a resolution. There is no resolution.
Yeah, in any direction. And that's not to say that ambiguity is bad, but usually at the very least, like, what is it? The Inception is famous for having an ambiguous ending. But at the very least, like, you know what happened to a lot of the characters, and it's just that question at the end of, wait, oh no, is he still stuck in the dream?
Yeah.
Or is he out of it? And you can think about it and talk about it. But this one is just like, yeah, everything's possible. We don't know.
It just
one,
seems
either one
like,
could have won, either one could have ended up with her, both of them could have ended up without her.
Yeah, and it's fine to like not have, like not realize the consequences of their actions. Art and, I mean, Patrick and Tashi, like their conversation in the car and her hooking up with him.
When it's just the windiest day of all time.
Yeah, but like him holding the racket and giving that signal like, yeah, I banged your wife again last night. Look at her. I did that. That has to have something, right?
Something has to pay off.
Something has to pay off, and it doesn't. And I am in the theater like, what? I think I burst out laughing. We both just kind of were aghast.
Yeah. We were like, oh, it's just over there? Because I guess he gets the motivation from Tashi to kind of throw it, like make sure he wins. So he's getting all those faults after they get to that third set. But then he also decides to, yeah, do the reveal on his racket, the way he places his ball to reveal that they hooked up recently.
Right.
And then Art lets him get the point. And so now they're back to even. And
well, so
even
it's
like from that standpoint, it's like, so who want, right. either person wants to win, or they wanted it to get back to tied so they could play one last game.
And I'm okay with like, the director or the story wanting it to leave it up to the viewer for interpretation. Like, was Patrick trying to get Art to win on his own volition by throwing fuel on the fire to really play him, really have that spark, give him that spark back with animosity? Was he trying to throw it really?
One of the two questions had to be answered, and you can leave the other one ambiguous. So at the end, you need to have something that shows that they're either all three not together at all, or two of them are together, or maybe they're all friends again, or whatever it is. Or you have to show us who wins, and then you can have that ending that they had where it's clearly she's pitting these two guys against each other, and mm-hmm. she actually likes just watching the competition of them. That goes back to all the way to when they first met. But without either, like you said, there's no resolution to the story in any way. And I don't even know where to go ambiguously. Everything is possible.
Yeah.
The where they ended it. And that's not ambiguity. That's just not writing the ending of a movie.
Right. Like the tennis ball that Tashi hits into the wilderness at Stanford, I too am lost in the woods of this tennis movie.
Now, a movie that you can't get lost in because it's pretty straightforward. Cheaper by the dozen. One and two. Go Steve Martin, not that stupid Zach Braff. So Zach Braff, Gabrielle Union one that came out in 2022. Maybe we'll watch it. It's on Disney Plus.
Well, who else knew that they made another one in 2022?
I mean, I had completely forgotten, but when I saw it, I remembered that like it coming out at that time, but even I didn't go see it. We had this realization at the same time because I was like, ooh, maybe we should watch Cheaper by the Dozen. You were like, yeah, maybe. And we were flipping through and we couldn't find anything else. You put it on. And then we were both like, at the very least, referencing things or like getting close to quotes. There were a few times where we both were like, that's an iconic scene, either from the trailer or what turned out to be true. We've both seen the first one at least like 100 times each.
Many times.
And we really like the movie. It's like a childhood nostalgic movie that we both really connect with. And I don't know. We've been dating for 8 years. We've been married for over three. And that's the first we had heard that we liked Cheaper by the Dozen.
Isn't it romantic? After 8 years of being together, we're still finding out things about each other. And isn't that real love?
Yes, that doesn't we can that... still find those things.
Yeah. And that you do the laundry.
The first one is better than the second one, even though the second one has a larger cast. And I think that's actually where the issue, you always do that. You make the sequel, you make the world bigger, you introduce new characters, you increase the stakes. So now the family isn't just dealing with how can we all stay together and make everything work out for us. But now we have a rival other family. I get that. But because they add in that Murtaugh family with Eugene Levy being the patriarch of it, it sets it up where you have to give some stories to his kids too. And so most of the time they combine them and then it becomes just like featured characters throughout the kids. Whereas basically everybody younger than the Allison Stoner character doesn't do anything in the second one. And Charlie's still a big deal, the oldest brother, but we talked about this. Hillary Duff must have been busy with other things.
Yeah.
Because she's clearly only there part of the days.
Yeah. And she like looks way too good. And that's part of the problem. First of all, she looks like she's doing an exclusive diet of cocaine and cigarettes because she was crazy, crazy thin in that second movie. But also because she was sort of reaching the height of her teen fame coming into now like young adult fame. Just gonna do it, love, 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 love. She had that perfume commercial that was everywhere. She was telling people, don't say gay. Like, she was in her pocket. So she went on that movie set, and her team said she cannot look like some Midwest cow-loving girl. She's got to look hot at all times. So, like, her being into fashion stuff sort of plays into that. But they're like, she's not going to have a bad look in this movie. She's not going to turn a bad look.
No, she barely has to, like, compete in any of the, like, lake stuff. She's never on a jet ski.
No, she just, like, sits there and reads a magazine and looks hot.
She showed up for the last day. Everybody had to compete in the actual competition. But other than that, she is literally sitting on a lawn chair reading a magazine basically the whole time.
Which, like, good for her. She looks good doing it, so I was more power to you. But the first one... Sorry, you say your thing.
I was going to say, by my count, I didn't cross-reference it to be 100% for sure, but it looks like they got all 12 kids to come back, which is pretty impressive. That's a lot of child actors that, who knows, within 2 years. 2 years is a long time for a kid.
Well, especially the older ones.
Maybe they just would have been out of it,
The older ones, the eldest brother is Superman.
Yeah, from Smallville.
Smallville was making the runs, right? Doing really well. You got Hillary Duff starring more stuff, making music. The eldest daughter.
It's Coyote Ugly, right?
Coyote Ugly, which is earlier, but still notable in her own right. So to get those guys back, even for those, you know, 5 or 10 minute scenes at a time is great.
And maybe that's why they did have to focus the stories a little bit more.
Yeah,
because even down to Allison Stoner, she's pretty famous, especially at that time. She's in the Missy Elliott video and was just kind of bouncing around Disney products, but much more famous than any of the other younger kids.
Yep.
And that's who they kind of focus the stories on in that second one. Whereas the first one truly does feel about this like family of 12. It's ridiculous that he's a Division I football coach and one can't find childcare. Like, I know it's 2003, but he's essentially coaching Northwestern is what they're kind of getting at. It's in Evanston or Evan Evanston, right? That Evanston, it's Illinois. Illinois. Right, yeah. It's so they're right there. And
Illinois Poly or whatever.
So he can't, yes, but he can't find the child care, which at that time he would have been making high hundred thousands, if not a million. They've gone up a lot since then. Plus, it's like a Northwestern standard, but he'd still be a guy making probably $800,000 to $1 million, somewhere in that range. Like, the price could be met. But then his solution is to bring his Division I football team to practice at his house that doesn't even really have, like, a full-size yard. It's like a corner lot. They don't even have anywhere where they can really set up any semblance of a football field, and yet they're there practicing. In today's day and age, once, like, Twitter or the message boards got a hold of that, he would just be flamed, and he wouldn't have had the opportunity to resign at the end of his first season. He would have been fired that week.
Well, we were talking about it. It's like, could you imagine being the parent of one of those players? It's like, oh, hey, how's football going? You doing good in practice? And they're like, Ma, you would not believe
what this guy
has us doing at his house, watching a bunch of these rambunctious toddlers just chasing him around. I haven't seen the field in a week, you know?
Yeah, so, no, we haven't practiced football.
No. Yeah.
Yesterday he made us go over to their neighbor's birthday party to wrangle up his kids. One of us had like a net. It was very weird. This is very different than last season.
But I think that first one works so much better as a story about family, because it does seem like, back to emotional stakes, the emotional stakes, it's not some petty rivalry between two middle-aged, semi-wealthy men. Mm-hmm. The first one is about, familial.
Belonging, yeah.
Yeah, belonging, really. And the fact that Mark, the little redheaded stepchild.
They call FedEx because he was dropped off by the FedEx guy, yeah, which is a pretty mean nickname.
Brutal. Him trying to find his own place in his family, and I think very relatable for a lot of people, even with one or two siblings, trying to figure out how you fit in your family dynamic and wanting to be noticed by your parents who are, you know, as you get older, busier with their careers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The mom's experiencing
and his frogs
too.
Keep freaking dying too.
Those frogs, poor thing. And they're all blaming it on him. Like, it's his fault. It's not his fault.
No, it's not.
No.
The dog's name is Gunner. And in the second one, he gets a little bit more to do. And it's funny, these movies are very wholesome. They are very, like, tightly PG. Like, they are not getting anywhere near PG-13 territory. But I did think it was funny, as they were trying to remain wholesome, how it goes all the way, like, full circle, almost back around. Because Carmen Electra plays the wife of Eugene Levy's character in the second one. It's his third wife, so she's much younger and very attractive. And I don't think that they want to, like, go outright and, like, show her in a bikini and be like, look at how hot this actress is. But that's, like, a thing you get when you cast Carmen Electra to be in your movie. So they kind of have the dog do it, and the dog, like, jumps her and, like, starts humping her. And I just thought it was odd that they're like, okay, we can't outright say she's hot, but we can have the dog do it. And it's
we can have the dog do it.
But it's, like, pretty aggressive. It's, like, 30 seconds of the dog, like, on top of her as she keeps, like, rolling around on the ground.
Yeah, I know. Well, I think, too, this happens a lot of times with, like, series on Disney Channel. As the audience is aging up, they can do a little bit more.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Risque jokes or whatever. So the audience aged up with this because it took a few years to come out with Cheaper by the Dozen 2.
We want to take these years to come up with Cheaper by the Dozen 3 now, though.
Yeah.
And I think we do have a pretty good idea here.
I think so, too. One second before we get into that. Did your older brother ever tell you a story about how you got to be in the family?
No, not that I remember. Maybe he tried that, but I don't think I don't remember ever, like, believing something that was told to me that was different.
So, yeah, that just reminded me because at first I was like, oh, yeah, that FedEx thing's really mean. But then I remember the lore that my older brother and I developed for our two younger siblings, where our younger sister Gracie was actually a monkey. We went to, like, a circus one day, and we're like, oh, look at that cute little monkey. It looks sad. We should rehome it. So we decided to bring her home and name her Gracie and do laser hair removal.
And how long did she believe that?
For, like, a couple years.
Did she ask, were, like, your dad and Cynthia on board with it, or did they know, or?
I don't know. They never confirmed or denied it, I think. But
they,
like,
just let it be.
We just, like, hammered it home so much that were like, yeah, you can't read because you're a monkey. Monkeys don't know how to read.
Well, hopefully we could hammer home this idea for Cheaper by the Dozen 3. It's with the amount of years, you can just keep it at this amount of years and it would actually be about perfect. It's right around 20 years since the first and second one, essentially. That one was in summer of 2005. The first one's in 2003. So you're right around 20 years. So every kid is going to be adult aged, probably. I mean, even the younger kids were 5 years old or so in that last one. So 19, 20 years, they're going to be probably outside of college. You get like the full adult version of this Baker family and bringing them back together. And our idea was to have some sort of family reunion and say they haven't been together since X time, somebody's wedding, whatever it would have been. And you bring them together for some sort of family reunion. But then I guess what is the story on top of it? I don't know. There's 12 kids. We'll come up with something.
The story on top, that is a story that is on top of it. Is that
just a family reunion idea?
Yeah, yeah, it's the family reunion. And one, trying to get all of them in the same spot. You have a holdout for the most famous of those children. So either it's Allison Stoner or it's Hilary Duff.
You probably Duff's save Hilary famous. Duff.
Yeah, you save Hilary Duff for last and bring her in. She like makes a last minute flight and makes it happen. And she's at the whatever. But trying to get, I think a wedding is a really good idea only because that is like a week long event really now.
Yeah.
So you have you could do a bachelor party with all the boy siblings or all the girl siblings, you know, split them up bachelorette style like that. You could do the rehearsal dinner, which is like the climax of the emotional climax of the movie with the conflict happening at the mm-hmm. rehearsal. Then everybody makes up and then Hilary Duff makes it there last minute for the wedding. I assume it would be one of the younger two twins or, you know,
there's a lot of kids that would be in that right age range to get married in that one. I feel like, yeah.
One of them's dead. That's why it's so important. Like if they can't get a couple of them. Well, yeah, I'm going to kill one of them. 12 of them can't be alive for 20 extra years. Like it's statistically improbable, but it creates more. Sure. It's possible, but it's statistically improbable.
Okay.
And it would create a more emotional depth of the film. If that's why it's so important that everyone go, because it's been a year since we lost whichever child, that we come together for this event and be together, and everyone's handling their grief very differently.
Can Gunner somehow still be alive, the dog?
Oh, it's Gunner the third.
Oh, we're on to the third. That makes more sense.
Him and Carmen, no.
Him and Carmen Electra got together.
Yeah, and had a... carried on the Gunner legacy.
Gunner Electra. Interesting.
You know what? No. Not even then. No.
All right.
Not touching that one.
So Disney, Steve Martin, let us know. We will sell that idea to you, but you do have to buy it off of us. Real quick, though, the 1950 version is actually based on a real story, and it was written as a novel, but as I was reading through it, spoilers for the 1950 version of... Cheaper by the Dozen, but the dad, Frank, is sent on a lecture tour to Europe, expecting to visit Prague and London. He phones Lillian from the station, but the line goes dead as he has a heart attack. After Frank's sudden death, the family agree that Lillian will continue her husband's work, beginning with giving his lectures in Europe. This enables the family to remain in their house rather than move to their grandmother's in California. Although, with a widowed working mother and one income, the children will have to assume much greater responsibilities. And like I said, this is based on a true story. So in the real Cheaper by the Dozen family, the dad died unexpectedly.
Wow.
Yeah. That's very different than him just like resigning in kind of an embarrassed way from the football team.
But if one of the kids is dead in our reboot, then that's sort of like paying homage to the 1950s version. There's an unexpected death in the family.
Well, there you have it. And I guess like you said, they've got some despair. I believe you said statistically improbable.
But there are a couple of spares in that bunch. Bonnie Hunt, still hot. I just Googled it, so
all right, let's get her involved, too. Would any of the kids still be with any of the Murtaughs? Maybe Charlie. He was, like, college age, so, like, that could work out.
Yeah.
Allison Stoner and Shark Boy, that's not going to happen.
No, he got too hot and married he became a fuck boy for sure.
There you go. Is Aaron Samuels still around, married to Nora?
Yeah.
Okay.
He doesn't have to be in the movie, really. No, but he would be a fun addition. So, yeah, keep him in.
Bring them back. Everybody's invited to Cheaper by the Dozen 3. Everybody is also invited. Grandview Theater and Draft House.
Very good.
Saturday, May 11th, 1:30 p.m. That's when the Fall Guy starts. After, we will be hosting a live version of Chops TV going over the movie. Like I said, anybody can come and you could possibly win two tickets. Just tweet at us at @_ChopsTV. The best Emily Blunt performance. If it matches up with the one I'm thinking in my head, you will win the two tickets.
And everyone, text me what you're going to wear because I still haven't figured it out.
All right. I have a coughing fit that's about to start up any second now, so we're signing off. Thanks for listening, everybody. Chops TV is made possible by people who subscribe to podcasts and viewers like you.